my tiny synagogue in Monroe, New York. There we packed a few hundred people into our little building and were quite impressed with ourselves for it. But in San Francisco, I looked out at what seemed like an endless sea of humanity, more people than I had ever spoken in front of before, and I felt a terror come over me. A man who had been to Monroe as part of the search process was sitting beside me, chortling softly. He knew exactly what I was feeling. But I don't think he realized how deep that moment was, that it was a kind of karmic replication of one of the most traumatic moments in my family's history. My mother grew up in the Depression in a succession of tenements and basement flats in Coney Island, New York. Her father was a mild-mannered floor scraper by day, but on evenings and weekends, he ran the most important synagogue choir in New York. He loved music intensely. It threw him into an ecstasy, whether it was a classic piece of Hasanut cantorial music, or Mozart, or a piece of bubblegum pop music on the radio, my Zadie savored it all. He cherished it. He closed his eyes as he sang or listened to it, and he went somewhere else altogether. I remember standing next to him on the altar during the high holidays and looking up at his face and wondering where in God's name he was, because he certainly wasn't here. Zadie was an autodidact. He had taught himself to play the piano and to read music. When he was engaged in that music, he was elsewhere, passionately and yearningly elsewhere. And he was determined to pass this great passion for music on to my mother, his eldest child, and to make sure that she could go much farther with it than he had been able to do. As soon as my mother was old enough to sit up straight at the piano, he and she began to make the long trek to the Henry Street settlement on the Lower East Side of Manhattan so that she could begin piano lessons there. The Henry Street settlement was one of those wonderful agencies FDR established during the Depression to make sure that American artists, writers, and musicians didn't wither away and die during the hard economic times. At Henry Street, world-class musicians offered free music lessons to the poor kids of New York. It was a pure meritocracy. No one paid a dime, but they only took kids who had considerable talent and an even more pronounced willingness to work very hard. My mother had both, and by the time she was a teenager, the Henry Street teachers had managed to turn her into something of a prodigy. She played piano like an angel, and she continued to practice like a demon. She gave concerts all over the city to adoring, enthusiastic crowds, and then one day, when she was 16 years old, she found herself seated at the grand piano on the stage of Carnegie Hall, the mecca of concert pianists. She was playing in the finals of the great citywide competition held at Carnegie Hall every year in those days. Brilliant pianists, prodigies from all over the city, played off against each other for a period of months until the field was narrowed down to just two. A great deal was at stake. The winner would receive a full scholarship to the Juilliard School and be sent on a nationwide concert tour. My mother had made mincemeat of all opposition, and now came the big moment she had been preparing for all her life. In the months leading up to this concert, she practiced the piece she would play every day with an urgent intensity. But none of that work had even begun to prepare her for the reality of this moment. She walked out onto the Carnegie stage and saw a great sea of faces, more human beings than she had ever seen in one place before, a multitude that dwarfed the audiences at the music parlors and high school auditoriums where she was used to playing. And when my mother reached the piano bench and sat down, she suddenly realized that all her preparations were inadequate for the intense reality of this actual moment, and she completely appled. She choked. She froze. She forgot what piece she was supposed to play. I'm not sure she was even conscious that she was supposed to be playing a piece at all. She just sat there on the stage of Carnegie Hall, frozen in terror for a long, long time. A quiet whisper began to come up from the great crowd, then a distinctly audible buzz. What was going on? How long was this chubby girl going to sit there doing nothing? Eventually, after a very, very long time, her teacher from Henry Street came out from backstage and sat down beside her and began to play the piece my mother had prepared, something by Mozart, I believe, or possibly Chopin. And after a very few bars, my mother began to come to her senses and to play along with him, and then finally he stopped, and she made it through the rest of the piece on her own. She played haltingly, and with many mistakes. Her concentration was shot, of course, so she didn't play well. But she did make it through to the end, and then she ran off the stage to a smattering of polite, pitying applause. That was the end of her career as a concert pianist. I fared better in San Francisco that night. I stared the crowd down and gave my speech. My mother was redeemed. Every year before the Days of Awe, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidic Judaism, held a competition to see who would blow the shofar for him on Rosh Hashanah. Now, if you wanted to blow the shofar for the Baal Shem Tov, not only did you have to blow the shofar like a virtuoso, but you also had to learn an elaborate system of kavanot, secret prayers that were said just before you blew the shofar to direct the shofar blasts and to see that they had the proper effect in the supernal realms. All the prospective shofar blowers practiced these kavanot for months. They were difficult and complex. There was one fellow who wanted to blow the shofar for the Baal Shem Tov so badly that he had been practicing these kavanot for years. But when his time came to audition before the Baal Shem, he realized that nothing he had done had prepared him adequately for the experience of standing before this great and holy man, and he appled. He choked. His mind froze completely. He couldn't remember one of the kavanot he had practiced for all those years. He couldn't even remember what he was supposed to be doing at all. He just stood before the Baal Shem in utter silence, and then, when he realized how egregiously, how utterly he had failed this great test, his heart just broke in two, and he began to weep, sobbing loudly, his shoulders heaving and his whole body racking as he wept. "All right, you're hired," the Baal Shem said. "But I don't understand," the man said. "I failed the test completely. I couldn't even remember one kavanah." So the Baal Shem explained with the following parable. In the palace of the king, there are many secret chambers, and there are secret keys for each chamber, but one key unlocks them all, and that key is the axe. "The king is the lord of the universe," the Baal Shem explained. "The palace is the house of God. The secret chambers are the sephirot, the ascending spiritual realms that bring us closer and closer to God when we perform commandments, such as blowing the shofar with the proper intention. And the secret keys are the kavanot. And the axe, the key that opens every chamber and brings us directly into the presence of the king wherever he may be, the axe is the broken heart. For as it says in the Psalms, God is close to the brokenhearted." Please imagine this. You are out for a social evening with those very close to you, family or close friends or both. The evening begins with a wonderful dinner, and then, out of some vague sense or perhaps a very strong sense of family tradition and obligation, you all go off after dinner to participate in a basically empty religious ritual. Or perhaps you are by yourself, but you attend this empty ritual because you have very pleasant associations of having done so with your family and friends back in Cleveland or Detroit or New Jersey. Or perhaps it is not so empty for you. Perhaps you feel a great deal at this service, but you're really not sure if it's you or the service, if it's the ritual itself or that peculiar pain you have been feeling in your heart lately. Or perhaps you feel very little, but every year you harbor the hope that you will feel something this time, even though you never really do, and you always feel a little disappointed about this. But you don't really mind attending this ritual. After all, it's tradition, and even though you are sleepy from all the food, the music is lovely, and the officiant is sometimes mildly amusing when he speaks. But basically, you go not because you anticipate that anything significant will happen, but rather because this is what the family does every year at this time, or this is what you used to do with them. This is what you have always done, so you will do it this year too. But this time, as you enter the sanctuary, everything feels different. so you look more closely. There are three immense books at the head of the sanctuary. A presence can be felt in the room so palpably you can almost see it. It hovers over the table like a colloid suspension, a smoky mist. Now you hear a deep, disembodied voice calling out names, and every time a name is called, it is written in one of the books. There is no hand, there is no quill. The pages of the book simply rustle and then quiver, and when the rustling stops, the name is already written. It is written in the Book of Life, while sighs of relief go up all around the room, or it is written in the Book of Death, while a cold silence grips the sanctuary amid much shuddering of shoulders and the sudden sucking in of breath. Or it is written in the Book of the Intermediaries, those who will spend the next 10 days in a state of suspended judgment in the process of transformation, after which they will be entered into one of the other two books. All of a sudden you hear your own name being called, and you want to cry out, "No, no, no, not now. I didn't realize this was real. I thought this was just some empty ritual. I am completely unprepared. I thought it was just what came after dinner with my family. Please give me some more time. Let me do something to affect the outcome of all this." But the voice continues to intone your name, and there is a rustling of the pages of the books, and your heart is gripped with terror as you wait to see in which one your name will be inscribed. Maybe you have just walked in cold and are now caught completely by surprise, or maybe you are not completely unprepared. Maybe you began your preparations the Saturday night before, at midnight, when the Slichot service was recited. Maybe you have thought a little about this night since then, or maybe you have even taken this day quite seriously and prepared for it for a long time. Maybe you began 7 weeks ago at Tisha B'Av, using that occasion, which stands for our estrangement from God, to contemplate the nature of your own estrangement from God, your estrangement from yourself, from the people you love, and from Judaism. And then, maybe when the shofar blew for the first time, exactly 1 month ago, on Rosh Chodesh Elul, you followed the advice of the rabbis and set aside time every day to contemplate your circumstances, to take stock of yourself in preparation for this critical moment. Maybe you meditated every day during this period. Maybe you came to the daily minyan and heard the shofar sound every morning there. Maybe you put your head down on your arm every morning during Tachanun, the prayer of fervent supplication, and prayed fiercely. Maybe you prayed more fiercely than you have ever prayed in your life. Maybe you prayed that you might finally overcome yourself and experience real transformation, that you might finally get a handle on the suffering, on the pain that has been weighing so hard on your heart for so long, or on the suffering you seem helpless to prevent yourself from inflicting on others. So maybe you walked in cold, or maybe you have been preparing for months, but no matter what, you now realize you are utterly unprepared. And you apple, you choke, you freeze. Whatever it was that you imagined might happen now, this is much stronger, much more powerful. This is no mere metaphor, no mere religious poetry. This is real. This is extremely powerful. And whatever preparation you might have made now seems utterly foolish, utterly inadequate, as the great voice intones your name and you hear it reverberating in the great room, and the pages of one of the great books begin to rustle, and you don't know which book it is. On the night my daughter Hannah was born, I was determined that the birth would be a grand spiritual event. We were already somewhat disappointed on this score. We had wanted a home birth, but the doctor had advised against it, fearing that, given Cheryl's age, she was a bit older than the standard childbearing age, the risk of complication would be too great. But we were determined to make the best of it anyway, or at least I was. I meditated through the night, and then when Cheryl's contractions began to come very close to each other, I intensified my meditation. Cheryl, of course, could have cared less. She had enough to concentrate on as it was. I helped her time the contractions, and I coached her breathing through them, but I continued to meditate between contractions. And then finally, it was time to go off to the hospital. All right, we couldn't have a home birth, but the doctor would deliver the baby in the relative quiet and privacy of a labor room without bright lights or invasive technologies. I would continue to meditate. We would have a spiritual experience by hook or by crook. But when we got to the hospital, the actual experience of birth began to take over, and it blew away all my pitiful attempts at preparation, like the exceedingly thin reeds that they were. First of all, there were, in fact, complications. Cheryl's water broke, but the labor wasn't progressing quickly enough, and the doctors became very concerned. For the first time, the possibility that things might not turn out well began to arise in our extremely naive minds. They wheeled Cheryl downstairs for x-rays. This terrified both of us. When they brought her back up, they hooked her up to fetal monitors and gave her Pitocin to induce more substantial contractions. The beeping and pulsing of electronic devices now filled the labor room, and more substantial contractions did in fact come, and they came with a vengeance. They were intensely painful, as they often are when induced, and now we were both hanging on for dear life. For the first and only time in our relationship, Cheryl spoke unlovingly to me. When I reached out to try to comfort her during a particularly excruciating contraction, she screamed, "Don't touch me!" I was crushed. My dreams of a spiritual experience had now completely evaporated, and I saw them clearly for the foolishness they had always been. My own wife hated me. Her life and the life of our new baby were now both in peril, and we were both completely terrified. Now the doctor informed us that things were getting so dicey that they had decided not to try to have the birth in the quiet and privacy of the labor room, but rather to wheel Cheryl into the formal delivery room, where all the latest medical technology would be available to them. Frankly, they now felt they needed all the help they could get. So, they wheeled Cheryl into the delivery room. She was grimacing horribly and focusing on her breathing with everything she had. I followed along behind, crestfallen and deeply anxious, my heart full of terror and utterly broken. And it was at that precise moment that God put in an appearance in the delivery room. It was Friday at sundown, and the last thing I saw through a window in the hallway before I went into the delivery room was the sun of Shabbat going down behind Mount St. Helena. There was a huge round lamp at the center of the delivery room ceiling. It gave the room a kind of spiraled spirituality, a radiance. When the birth itself occurred, the room was full of every kind of bodily fluid imaginable, the most intense breathing I have ever witnessed, the skilled movements of the doctors, the nurses, and the mother, and the presence of God. The presence of God was so thick and so real, and so absolutely connected to the pain and the anxiety and the biological trauma of birth, that the fantasy of birth I had first envisioned now seemed downright stupid. And maybe that's how you feel right now, if you think you have been preparing for this event for months, but walk in here to find the reality of Rosh Hashanah is making a mockery of these preparations, exposing them for the thin and inadequate reeds that they are. You feel devastated, you feel stupid, all those hours of practice, and now your name has been called and you are standing on the stage choking away like a champ. You can't remember one thing you resolved to do. You tried to recall your idea of what this should feel like, but it all seems so small and so thin next to this immense and pulsing reality, next to your name being called and the pages rustling in a book that might mean death or might mean life. And here is the bad news I have come to deliver. This is a true story, and it is not about me or my mother or a man desperate to blow the shofar. It is about you. It is really happening, and it is happening to you, and you are seriously unprepared. And it is real, whether you believe in God or not. Perhaps God made it real, and perhaps God did not. Perhaps God created this pageant of judgment and choice, of transformation, of life, and of death. Perhaps God created the book of life and the book of death, teshuvah, and the blowing of the shofar. Or perhaps these are all just inventions of human culture. It makes no difference. It is equally real in any case. The weeks and the months and the years are also inventions of human culture. Time and biology are inventions of human culture. Language and stories, love and tragedy are inventions of human culture. But they are all matters of life and death, all real, and all inescapable. Even though we invented the idea of weeks, we die when our allotted number of weeks has gone by. So if this event is merely the product of human culture, it is the product of an exceedingly rich culture, one that has been accumulating focus and force for 3,000 years. Or perhaps God made the reality that all this human culture seeks to articulate. Perhaps God made a profoundly mixed world, a world in which every second confronts us with a choice between blessings and curses, life and death. A world in which our choices have indelible consequences. A world in which life and death, blessings and curses, choose us, seek us, find us every moment. And we live with the consequences of our choices, and perhaps we have chosen arbitrary spiritual language to express these things. Or perhaps God made human culture so that we would express these things precisely as we have in every detail. It makes no difference. What makes a difference is that it's real, and it is happening right now, and it is happening to us. And it is utterly inescapable, and we are completely unprepared. This moment is before us with its choices, and the consequences of our past choices are before us, as is the possibility of our transformation. This year, some of us will die, and some of us will live, and all of us will change. And there is nothing in the world more real than this. Rabbi Akiva used to say, everything is given on pledge, and a net is spread for all the living. The store is open, and the storekeeper allows credit. The ledger is open, and the hand writes. Whoever wishes to borrow may come and borrow, but the collectors go around and exact payment, whether we realize it or not. And maybe it is inescapable because God has made it so, because it is part of some divinely ordained scheme. Or maybe it is merely inescapably fixed by the endless and ageless web of Jewish religious culture, the nascent eruption of these ideas in the Bible, and their subsequent reinterpretation in the Talmud, and their loving elaboration at the hands of the medieval liturgists, the month of Elul, Slichot, the endlessly rich liturgy of the Rosh Hashanah Musaf, additional service, the blowing of the shofar, the Torah readings, and the readings from the prophets, the liturgical insertions for the 10 days, Kol Nidre, Yom Kippur, and its unique liturgy, its unique Musaf, Mincha, Maftir Yonah, and that last desperate moment at Neilach, when we are all crushed together so desperately, shuddering at the final closing of the gates, all of it accumulating for thousands of years until we are inexorably hammered into this moment of inescapable existential choice, life and death, good and evil. And this is an immense reality, and all our resolutions and strategies for coping, all our attempts to manipulate reality, all our attempts to get cute with life, are thin reeds in the face of this immensity. Even if we've spent months preparing, when we reach this moment, we realize we are utterly unprepared. And this is what we call heartbreak. Heartbreak is precisely the feeling that we have done our best, we have given it our all, but it hasn't been enough, not nearly enough. And this is what we mean when we say God is close to the brokenhearted. And this is what we mean when we say, Ein banu ma'asim, we have no good deeds. This is what it says in Avinu Malkeinu, that lovely song with the haunting, heartbreaking melody we all love to sing so much on Rosh Hashanah. Avinu Malkeinu, Chaneinu Va'aneinu, our Father, our King, be gracious to us, be gratuitously loving, and answer us even though we don't deserve it. Ki ein banu ma'asim, because we have no good deeds to invoke in our own defense. In other words, now that we are standing in the face of this immense reality, we realize that there is nothing we can do about it, that all our deeds are as nothing. We realize that we have greatly overestimated our cleverness and our potency. We have overestimated the efficacy of our conscious behavior, and we have underestimated the persistence and the depth of our destructive tendencies. We realize that our attempts to do good are very small next to the unconscious havoc we constantly wreak to our right and to our left. What are we? What is our life? What is our goodness? What our righteousness? Asks the prayer we recite each morning at Shacharit. Master of all worlds, it is not on account of our own righteousness that we offer supplications before you, but rather on account of your great compassion. What are we? What is our life? What is our goodness? What our righteousness? What is our helpfulness? What our might? What can we say in your presence, Lord, our God, and God of our fathers? Indeed, all our mightiest people are as nothing before you. Our people of renown, as though they never existed. The wise, as if they knew nothing. The intelligent, as if they understood nothing. For most of our doings are worthless, and the days of our lives are vain in your sight. Our imagined superiority to the beast is just an illusion, and everything we do is just a passing breath. There was a time when our biblical ancestors thought they really had things figured out. They thought they knew what to do. They thought they had life under control. All they had to do was to make the prescribed sacrifices at the great temple in Jerusalem, and everything would be taken care of. Everything would be all right. But then they ran into the immense wall of reality, and they saw what a thin reed this idea was. And it makes no difference how we understand that immensity. If you were a biblical prophet, the immensity was the social reality of the day. People were starving. People were homeless. Strangers and orphans and widows were uncared for. The sacrifices, the rituals of the temple, were a very thin reed in the face of this immensity. And the prophets told us so. And if you were a rabbi of the Talmudic era, you saw this immensity in theological terms. The sacrificial cult was a thin reed next to Israel's apostasy at the time of the First Temple and the rampant, baseless hatred that prevailed at the time of the Second. And if you are a modern historian, then the immensity was a simple historical one. The sacrificial cult was an exceedingly thin reed next to the invincible might of the Roman army that destroyed everything in its path and would have destroyed Jerusalem and the temple no matter how well we had taken care of the helpless in our midst, no matter how pious we had been, no matter how loving we had been to one another. So it makes little difference how we view this immensity. The point is, Ein banu ma'asim. We have no good deeds. We thought we knew what to do. We thought we had things figured out, but then we ran into the wall of reality. We turned around and saw an immense crowd looking back at us at Carnegie Hall. We suddenly found ourselves in the presence of an immense being, the master of the holy name. We were suddenly hooked up to fetal monitors, suddenly wheeled into the operating room, and we appled, we choked. We understood that all our preparations had been inadequate. that the reality we now confronted was so powerful and irresistible that it had blown all our attempts to prepare for it away, like so many chaffs of straw. The sacrificial cult was over. The audience was filing out of Carnegie Hall. The birth was underway, and all those hours of meditation and prayer and practice now seemed like a cruel joke. The temple was destroyed. The walls of the city had crumbled. This is what we call heartbreak. This is why I always feel that the high holidays start at Tisha B'Av, the day when we mourn the fall of the temple, the day precisely 7 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, when we begin our preparations for reconciliation with God by acknowledging our estrangement from God. This is the day when the walls come tumbling down, and we begin to acknowledge our heartbreak, when we begin to acknowledge the futility of our present course of action, when we begin to acknowledge the fact that we are utterly unprepared for what we have to face in life. This is when the walls of our psyche begin to break down. And then comes Elul, and with these walls already down, we try to see our real circumstances. We try to see who we really are and what we really have. We try to acknowledge the emptiness of what we have been doing. And then Rosh Hashanah itself arrives, and perhaps this is the beginning of the process for you, or perhaps this is its culmination, or perhaps you are somewhere in between, but wherever you are in this, this much is sure. Ein banu ma'asim. You have no good deeds. You are utterly unprepared. Nothing you have done or can do has had or will have any efficacy at all. So what do we do at a moment like this when we become so painfully aware that there is nothing we can do at all? The Midrash from Tana Devet Eliyahu Zutza with which we began is quite explicit. We do three things. And the good news after all this very bad news is that we already know how to do them. In fact, we do them every year at the High Holidays. The first thing we do during the High Holidays is come together. We stand together before God as a single spiritual unit. We do this out of a very deep instinct. Just stand out on the street in front of the synagogue and try to stop people from coming into our services, and you will see the great force of this incredible instinct Jews have to be together with other Jews at this moment. They have no tickets, they never even called. But just try to stop them, and you will feel the force of this instinct. We need each other now. We need each other deeply. Here in the full flush of the reality of the life and death nature of this ritual, here in the full flush of our impotence as individuals to meet this most urgent emergency, our need for each other is immense. We heal one another by being together. We give each other hope. Now we know for sure by ourselves, Ein banu ma'asim, there is nothing we can do. But gathered together as a single indivisible entity, we sense that we do in fact have efficacy as a larger, transcendent spiritual unit, one that has been expressing meaning and continuity for 3,000 years, one that includes everyone who is here and everyone who is not here, to echo the phrase we always read in the Torah the week before the high holidays begin. All those who came before us, and all those who are yet to come, all those who are joined in that great stream of spiritual consciousness from which we have been struggling to know God for thousands of years. We now stand in that stream, and that is the first thing we do. And then, second, hitvadu, we make confession. We open our hearts. We acknowledge the futility of our actions. We see our attempts to be cute with this life, to manipulate it, for the thin reeds they are, and we resolve to give them up. And we are able to find the courage to do this precisely because we are gathered ba'aguda achat, in one single spiritual unit, precisely because we now realize that the enterprise doesn't depend on our own single, puny, thin, pale stratagems, but on our belonging to something much larger and deeper and thicker than that. And third, we perform this service, this ancient ritual of judgment and transformation, of forgiveness, of life and death. We perform it because we got it from God. God came out of the mist and the mystery. God donned a talit and passed before the ark. God dressed himself in the implements of human culture and revealed this service to us through our own evolution as a people. So, on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, there we are, Ba'aguda Achat, pressed together in a large room, a single spiritual unit, helping each other to acknowledge our actual condition and reciting this ancient service given to us by the divine physician as a medicine for that condition. And that condition is this. This is real. This is very real. This is absolutely inescapable. And we are utterly unprepared. And we have nothing to offer but each other and our broken hearts. And that will be enough. Chapter 6. The horn blows, the gates swing open, and we feel the winds of heaven. Rosh Hashanah. The three books are opened in heaven. When the shofar sounds 100 times, it blows open the gates of heaven. When the shofar sounds 100 times, it forms a bridge between heaven and earth, and we enter heaven on that bridge. When the shofar blows 100 times, it cracks the shell of our awareness wide open, and suddenly we find ourselves in heaven. When the shofar blows 100 times, we hear the voice of heaven in it. We experience revelation. God's voice comes down to earth on the same bridge we use to go up to heaven. On Rosh Hashanah, all the inhabitants of the earth pass before God in heaven. Rosh Hashanah is Yom Harat Olam, the day the world is born, the day heaven gives birth to the earth. Rosh Hashanah is Yom HaZikaron, the day of remembrance, the day we remember that our roots are in heaven, the day heaven remembers us. Rosh Hashanah is the day of kingship, the day we acknowledge the sovereignty of heaven over our earthly lives. In the Une Tane Tokef prayer, the liturgical high point of both the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services, the curtains between heaven and earth are pulled back and we catch a glimpse of the celestial mechanics that govern the earth. In this prayer, we acknowledge the awesome power of this day, its pure sanctity, the deeply felt dominion of heaven, the heavenly roots of compassion and justice. This day, even angels are alarmed, seized with fear and trembling as they declare, "The day of judgment is here, for even the hosts of heaven are judged. And this day all who walk the earth are brought before you. You determine the life and decree the destiny of every creature." On Rosh Hashanah it is written, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed, how many will leave this world and how many will be born into it. Who will live and who will die? Who will live out the limits of their days and who will not? Who will perish by fire and who by water? Who by sword and who by beast? Who by hunger and who by thirst? Who by earthquake and who by plague? Who will rest and who will wander? Who will be poor and who will be rich? Who will be humbled and who will be exalted? But teshuvah and prayer and righteous acts transform this severity, the evil of the decree. As the Une Tane Tokef closes, we are reminded once again of the vast gulf separating our earthly existence from the heavenly expanse we glimpse on Rosh Hashanah. Our origin is dust, and our end is dust. We spend our life earning bread. We are like a clay vessel easily broken, like the withering grass, like a fading flower, a passing shadow, a fugitive cloud, a fleeting breeze, scattering dust, a vanishing dream. But you are King, Eternal God. Your years have no limit, your days have no end. Your sublime glory is beyond comprehension. Your mysterious name is beyond explanation. If we have been paying attention for the past 7 weeks, none of this should come as a surprise. At Tisha B'Av, we became aware of our brokenness. During Elul, we cultivated an awareness of our actual circumstances, the dust we will return to, the fragility and impermanence of our life. If we succeeded in awakening to our lives, we saw clearly how every moment of our lives, every breath, every thought, is only a passing shadow, a fugitive cloud, a fleeting breeze, a vanishing dream. This being the case, how do we acquire a toehold in this world sufficient to do teshuvah? How do we achieve the transformation our contemplation has shown us we need to make? As Shlichot dawns, there is a sense of urgency, even desperation about our plight. But we have also become aware of the limits of our own powers. We are completely unprepared for this. We don't know how to do teshuvah. We are incapable of transforming ourselves. For this, we need to enter a realm beyond the one we usually occupy, a consciousness beyond our own. For this, we need the limitless, the endless, the incomprehensible, the measureless, the mysterious. In short, we need heaven. This is where Rosh Hashanah carries us. Something very strange happens to the Torah just before Rosh Hashanah. It disappears from the weekly services as if it has fallen into a void. The Torah is read in a cycle of weekly readings that is both completed and begun again on Simchat Torah, the last day of the festival of Sukkot, some 10 days after Yom Kippur. Toward the end of the cycle, Moses dies a noble and tragic death, poised on the border of the promised land he will never enter. Then the round of weekly Torah readings halts and remains suspended for several weeks until the long round of holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shmini, Atzeret, and Simchat Torah, is completed. Then, suddenly the Torah begins again in a great rush with the first strains of Genesis and its account of creation. Life bursts into being out of nothing, out of the void the Torah had fallen into after the death of Moses. There is something of this feeling about Rosh Hashanah as well. Rosh Hashanah is, among other things, Yom Harat Olam, the day the world is born. Rosh Hashanah is also the day that the world burst into being out of nothing, and it stands for both that event and its continuous renewal. Every moment of our lives, the world bursts into being out of nothing, falls away, and then rises up again. Every moment we are renewed by a plunge into the void. This void is called heaven. There is a void at the beginning of creation and a void afterward. Life is the narrow bridge between these two emptinesses. Usually, all our focus is on the narrow bridge of our own life rather than on what comes before or after. In its accounts of both the death of Moses and the creation of the universe, the Torah focuses our attention instead on the void. One Sunday morning, the first summer I was a rabbi in San Francisco, I received 2 phone calls within moments of each other. The first concerned a death that had just occurred on 27th Avenue on the north side of Golden Gate Park, and the second concerned a birth that had just occurred on 27th Avenue on the south side of the same park. I was struck by the coincidence of events, this life and this death taking place at opposite ends of the same street at almost the same moment, and I spoke of it often from the pulpit, and when I did, I focused on the events themselves, the birth and the death. I spoke of how the simultaneity of these two events seemed to symbolize the Jewish view of life as a whole system, a richness in which birth and death are in equilibrium at either end of a continuum. My wife, the author Cheryl Jaffe, was also impressed by this experience, but when she wrote about it in her novel Interior Designs, her focus was quite different. She said, "These things are on the same continuum, but there is a park in between, a wild and beautiful place without streets and numbers. Flowers bloom there, and there are lakes where egrets wade. The cypresses are dark and cool. It is a beautiful place, as large and deep as a dream. But I hurry through there almost daily on my way to and from the places where the streets are numbered. Like the Torah, Cheryl focused not on the events of this world, not on birth and not on death, but on the void in between. And she found this nothingness to be a wild, fecund place, a place we don't notice in our fascination with the world of things and numbers. The Kabbalah also points to a wild and fecund nothingness at the core of existence. According to the Kabbalah, before creation there was nothing but heaven. God existed as the Ein Sof, the endlessness, an emptiness so charged, so powerful that nothing could coexist with it. In order to create the universe, God had to extract the divine essence from a tiny sphere at the center of the Ein Sof. This sphere became the known universe. But the point is, the universe came out of nothing. It was born from an endless emptiness, or as my grandmother Masha used to say, in a pungent paraphrase of a saying from the Talmud, "You come out of one black hole and you go into another." This is the account of the Torah as well. According to the Torah, human life emerged from the tohu vavohu, a howling, empty chaos, and the medium of its creation was Ruach Elohim, the divine breath, wind and air, nothingness in motion, by which a lump of dust and earth was transformed into a nefesh chayim, a living soul. But the word nefesh, soul, also means a nothingness. It also means air, or breath. Breath, ruach nefesh, is precisely an energized nothingness, a dynamic emptiness at the center of our being that mirrors the dynamic emptiness out of which life arose. But there is another, somewhat darker sense in which this world seems to have arisen out of nothing. Earlier I mentioned the denial of death by the philosopher Ernest Becker, and Becker's observation that we human beings seem to be the only creatures afflicted with the mysterious capacity to understand that we are going to die, and that it is precisely this fact that seems to call us to the world, to our life's work, and to God. We try to compensate for this dread intelligence by constructing what Becker calls affirmation systems. We see the void, and it terrifies us. It looks to us like utter negation. So we try to set up something in life that affirms our existence. Against death, which we see as the ultimate failure, we offer up success. Against death, which we see as the ultimate emptiness, we offer up the acquisition of objects. Against death, which we see as the end of all feeling, we offer up the pursuit of pleasure. Against death, which we see as the final stillness, we offer up a ceaseless rage of activity. Against death, which we see as the ultimate impotence, we offer up the glorification of our own power. But in the process, we give up our nefesh, the nothingness out of which life arises, the emptiness that gives our lives meaning. And we give it up because we are frightened of it. It reeks of all we are trying to deny. Consequently, we've become a nation of workaholics, a people who have come to believe that we can conquer death by dint of our own powers, by a ceaseless swirl of activity. To rest is to die, so we never permit ourselves a moment's rest, a moment's nefesh, a moment's nothingness. We think we know how the world works. We think we even know how the mind works. We have become enchanted with how capable we've become with our computers, our jet planes, our space travel, our genetic engineering. We've talked ourselves into believing that we can solve any problem, overcome any obstacle, if we just do more, if we just think about it long and hard enough, if we just try a little harder. But our problem is not that we don't try hard enough. It is that we try too hard. It's that we have such an exaggerated belief in the force of our own effort that we never stop trying. Our pursuit of pleasure and success is relentless, feverish, sometimes bordering on the demonic. We never rest. We have portable computers and faxes and email that we take on vacation. We have phones in our cars. We have call waiting so that even our interruptions are interrupted. Even those small moments of contemplation, of nefesh, of nothingness, we used to enjoy on vacation or even just driving back and forth between errands, even these are denied us. But in spite of our constant effort, there is failure and death all around us, on the downtown streets and in the testimony of our own bodies. We try not to see it, but the psychic squint we have to make in order to do this reduces everything in our line of sight, not just the void we are trying to ignore. And this squinting requires a tremendous expenditure of energy, energy we desperately need, and it never works anyway. Sooner or later, we will find ourselves tied to a chair under the bare bulb of the truth. Sexually, physically, and mentally, we humans peak in our early 20s. After that, we decline. Our heart muscles weaken, and we lose stamina and endurance. Our blood pressure increases, and our arteries harden, and this affects our brain, heart, kidneys, and the extremities, and none of them take it well. The gastrointestinal system also begins to slow. The prostate enlarges. Our hormones slow to a trickle, making us look older and feel less energy and initiative. Our bones leach calcium and phosphates and become fragile. The skin thins, dries, and becomes discolored. Our brain atrophies. Our nerve cells waste away. We suffer memory loss, sometimes severe. Birth is our only real success, and even that success doesn't really belong to us. It belongs to God. In the beginning, God created us out of nothing. It is all downhill from there, and that's the part that belongs to us. The long, slow return to nothing. But if we stop resisting it for a moment, it is precisely this return that can save us. It is precisely this return that can renew us, return us to heaven. Human renewal is one of the universe's great mysteries, one we tend to take for granted. When our cars run out of gas, we fill them up with gas. When our batteries run down, we recharge them with electrical energy. But when we human beings run down, we simply plunge into nothingness. We sleep. Nothing happens to us when we sleep, and it is precisely this nothing that restores us. When we lose touch with this sense of nefesh, of space, of emptiness, we feel overwhelmed, overstressed, overburdened. So for many of us, the question is, how do we find our way back to heaven? How do we relocate that spaciousness out of which we emerged? How do we connect with our nefesh? There is a story in the Torah about someone getting their nefesh back, although I use the word someone advisedly because the someone in question is God. After 6 furious days of creating the world, the Torah says of God, Shavat vayinafash. God stopped and did nothing, or literally, God stopped and re-nefeshed himself, re-ensouled himself. So we get back to heaven by doing nothing. We reconnect with the nothing that gives our life meaning by stopping. The Torah has another word for this nothingness, which also permeates the Rosh Hashanah liturgy, and that is the word kadosh, or holy. The angels cry out kadosh as they circle the heavenly throne. It is used for the first time in reference to Shabbat, that sacred stopping. After that, kadosh fills the Torah, and the imperative of the Torah is that we fill the world with holiness as well. Holiness is the great nothing that appears in all the religious traditions of the world in various poetic guises. It is an ineffable intensity, an oceanic sense, a warm flash of light, a marriage of the soul, a mighty wind of resolution, a starry grace, a burning bush, a wide-stretching love, an abyss of pure simplicity. And as we have mentioned, it is the word the angels cry, the word that rings throughout heaven. In short, holiness is an all-encompassing emptiness. In short, holiness is heaven. And Rosh Hashanah is about our connection to heaven. Rebbe Nachman of Bratslav said that when the shofar blows 100 times on Rosh Hashanah, a bridge is formed between heaven and earth. And those mysterious otherworldly sounds the shofar makes are a secret language that is understood only in heaven, according to the Tiferet Uziel. Rosh Hashanah is the day we are remembered in heaven, as God remembers Sarah in the Torah reading we read on the first day of the holiday. And the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, that we read on the second day, affirms the covenant between Abraham and God, that indissoluble connection between heaven and earth. When we pray for forgiveness on Rosh Hashanah, we do so not on the basis of our merits, which we realize are woefully inadequate, but on the strength of that connection. Lord of the worlds, we pray on that morning. Not upon our merit do we rely in supplication, but upon your boundless compassion. What are we? What is our piety? What is our righteousness? What is our attainment, our power, our might? What can we say to you? All the mighty are as nothing, the famous as if they didn't exist, the wise utterly lacking in wisdom. The greatest part of our actions are utterly meaningless, the days of our lives an emptiness. Our superiority over the beast is an illusion. Our life is a fleeting breath, but we are your people, your partners, connected to you by the covenant. Without this connection to heaven, we can't make teshuvah. We can't forgive others or ourselves without it. We can't see ourselves without it. We can't know ourselves. These things are simply too difficult to do. Our capacities, our vision, our powers, our tolerance for pain are too limited. Our capacity for self-deception and rationalization too persistent. Recently, a young man came to see me in my office seeking advice. He had been in a relationship with a wonderful young woman for several years. She was beautiful and kind, and he was very fond of her. His family loved her and was urging him to marry her. She also wanted to marry, but he found himself balking. He thought he might love her, but he didn't feel challenged by her. She had unquestioningly adopted every idea he had ever expressed as her own. She had changed her life to adapt to his, but she had never asked him to change for her sake in any way. It worried him that she never seemed able to discuss the things that were important to him. She simply wasn't a big talker. She was a nourisher. She supported every idea he ever had. She adopted his lifestyle as her own. His brother told him, "You're an idiot. Marry her right away. You'll never have it this good again." His parents told him, "She's so sweet. She's so beautiful. She loves you so much. What are you waiting for?" But he worried that she wasn't really his soulmate. He wondered if he shouldn't be with someone who pushed him a bit more, who brought more of herself to the relationship. This worry became a kind of torment. He thought about it constantly. Was he just resisting commitment? Was he afraid of intimacy, of giving up his independence? If so, he would be glad to give up this resistance. But how could he be sure? Perhaps this really wasn't the right relationship for him. Perhaps this woman, as lovely and as loving as she was not his true partner, the one with whom he was destined to spend his life. But how could he know for sure? Was this the authentic resistance of his soul, or was he just a big kid who refused to grow up? I didn't know the answer, I told him, and neither did he. He was disappointed with my first point, but certainly agreed with the second. "Who does know the answer?" I asked him. The question hung in the air between us for a long, pregnant moment before the obvious answer presented itself, coalescing on the ether, like a colloid suspension suddenly taking form. God knew the answer to this question. I didn't know it, and neither did the young man, but God knew it. And the answer would not come through effort. It would not come through exertion. It would not come through filling the mind with reasons and arguments. It would only come when his mind was empty. It would only come from heaven. It would only come after his question was cast into the void, the great nothingness at the core of this young man's being. It would only come if he asked God for it. and it might have to hang suspended between heaven and earth for a long time before it began to take form. One summer, after a very stressful year, problems in the congregation, financial crises, illness, conflict, and trouble, Cheryl and I took a vacation to a small deserted town by